Hi, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, everybody. My name is Doug. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
It's really great to be here. We got an opportunity to tour the city a little bit this afternoon and really had a good time. Really liked what we saw. We've got a great place here. I'm used to New York City. I work in New York City, and I got to tell you, it's a little bit different attitude around here than it is in New York City, and I'm very, very grateful. I want to thank Pally, Eric, everybody that put together, everybody that worked toward putting this together and communicated with us and basically put in the effort to make this happen. I want to thank them very, very much. To get an opportunity to do something like this is always a pleasure and an honor, especially to be asked to speak in another country. The responsibility is kind of big when you're asked to do that. The format for tonight is we're going to do about an hour and 20 minutes, something like that, on a little bit about on step one. And then we'll have the speaker portion of the evening with a break in between. Step one, I just want to start off a little bit with step one. I'm going to tell my story later tonight, so I won't get too much involved in my own personal experience. That'll show through in my story, but I do want to just mention a little bit about step one. Step one is probably the most misunderstood steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. People who really think that they understand step one and are working step one don't really truly understand the step one concept of powerlessness. There's a great quote out of this book, and I always, when I quote out of books, I always quote incorrectly. But it says, "Who among us wishes to admit complete defeat? You know, bottle in hand, we've warped our lives to such a point that only an act of divine providence could relieve us of our alcoholism." Now, that was written in the first step of the step book, and it's a great sentence. But what if it's true? What if it's true? What if we have warped our minds to such a degree that only an act of divine providence can relieve us of our alcoholism? You know what an act of divine providence is? It's like God shining down out of the clouds and giving you the whammy. You know what I mean? Like, that's a heavy concept to get with. But when I got really involved in understanding the big book and getting an experience with the recovery process, my concept of step one broadened and deepened. And in a nutshell, the obsession of the mind is I have a mind that is going to bring me back to drinking. There's very little I can do on my own unaided will to stay separated from alcohol. If I'm powerless over alcohol, admitting powerlessness is admitting that I can't stay away from alcohol. I could have the best reasons in the world. I could have a firm resolve. I swear I'm never going to drink again. You know, there's one of the places where Doug and I speak, there's a book, the original big book, that Bill Wilson had. I'm sorry, the original Bible that Bill Wilson had. And in that Bible is all these, notations that he wrote in there to his wife. "This, Lois, I am never going to drink again. I swear on this Bible and on my soul that I'm never going to drink again." And then right below that is, "Well, this time I'm never going to really drink again." And then below that is, "Well, I'm really, really, really going to try this time." I mean, now, I think if you're alcoholic out there, you understand the concept of knowing that drinking is a really, really bad idea, yet ending up drunk. Now, consider for 1 minute that it's your ego that's taking credit for taking that drink. "Oh, I changed my mind about this AA thing. You know, I was just fed up, or she left me, or I lost a job, or I got that promotion." Whatever excuse you use, isn't it really just a fallacy, that particular excuse? Because did you ever drink when it was raining? Did you ever drink when it was sunny? Did you ever drink when you lost a job? Did you ever drink when you got a really good job? Did you ever drink when she or he left you? Did you ever drink when he or she stayed? The outside circumstances really have little or no control over why you put alcohol in your body. But if you are alcoholic, you have what's known as an obsession, that drink that brings you back to alcohol one more time, even though you know it's a bad idea. That, in turn, is coupled with a physical craving, which Doug talks about a lot better than me, but it's basically the first drink always does one thing. It asks for the second drink. Second drink insists on the third drink. The third drink demands the fourth drink. You want the 15th drink more than you wanted the 14th, because the more alcohol in your body, the more the craving is present. So if you have a mind that takes you back to alcohol no matter what, and your body ensures that you keep drinking it, that's really, really bad. That's really a bad thing. And that's the first half of step one. Doug, you want to talk on step one a little bit?
How many people here have heard the saying, and there's a lot of sayings that really aren't true, and we hear them in the States all the time, because AA has gotten so watered down to where we're at somewhere about a 7 to 13% sobriety rate after a year, where we used to be in the big book, and I'll show you where it says, we used to have a 75% sobriety rate. 75% would make it past a year. That's huge. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed the path. So when I read that, I wanted to make sure I knew exactly what that path was. Being of a legal mind, I wanted to make sure that I knew all the ins and outs and I can carve this legal stuff up and find out how I could drink legally. That's what I wanted to do. And as I learned, I couldn't drink legally because it was the first drink gets you drunk. How many heard that? The first drink is the one that gets you drunk. Well, I used to think, well, then these people are lightweights, because it was normally the 18th drink that got me drunk. It wasn't the first drink. And so what would happen with me is I didn't understand what they meant by that. And when it was clarified to me from a doctor in South Miami Hospital, of which, by the way, I was shipped out to this mental institution for a 28-day program, and they kept me in for 72 days. And I like to tell people because they liked me so much, but that's how bad I was, okay? And this doctor put it like this. I wish I had a chalkboard because I like writing. But if you could picture, there's four boxes, okay? You have four boxes. And a non-alcoholic, like my wife, who's a non-alcoholic, I never understand how she could have a half a glass of wine and just leave it alone. It kind of just blows my mind. But what happens is when she takes a drink of alcohol, it comes in as alcohol, box number one. Follow me? Box number two, it turns to this thing, formaldehyde, if you will. It gives you this elusiveness, this woo, right? Then her body says, this is poison, shut down, no more drinking. Of which she listens to her mind and she shuts down and she stops drinking. And then it turns into the barley and hops, the sugar, if you will. And then it goes, that's box three. And then box four, H2O, water, it passes through us. Follow me? This is the way it works for us. It comes in as alcohol. It turns to formaldehyde. We get this woo. And instead of our body shutting down, it's like, let's kick it up a notch. And if this made me feel one drink, 20 is going to make me feel 20 times better, right? So now we're just drinking. But what happens is our third box is not the barley and hops. Our third box is a codeine-like substance that transmits in our mind. It actually forms a fluid. Only us have that codeine-like substance in our mind that produces the more. And we are restless, irritable, and discontent until we can feel the sense of ease at once taken by another drink. And that's what's talked about in the big book. Okay? I think you all have experienced that. If not, then you're not an alcoholic. Because you could stop any time or moderate. I couldn't. Once I put the alcohol in my body and went to alcohol, formaldehyde, then I went to this codeine-like substance, which I will always have. I crossed the line. How many people say, I crossed that line? It's like losing a leg. You can never get it back. Once it goes to that codeine-like substance, then it goes to the barley and hops, then it goes to the water, and then we're out. Okay? When that was mentioned to me, when the actual medical part was mentioned to me like that, on how we have crossed the line and we produce a codeine-like substance, which is the most addictive substance in our mind, by taking one drink. So it really wasn't the 20th drink. It wasn't that everybody was such a lightweight and they could only have one drink and then they were drunk. It was that when I took the one drink, when I took that first drink, it was virtually impossible for me to stop. Now, there may have been some occasions where I did stop. I don't remember ever trying, but I might have once or twice. Because, see, I knew I just couldn't stop drinking. That's ridiculous. Why would I do that to myself? If I ever get a phone call in the middle of the night and the guy's drunk, I'm like, he's like, do you want me to stop? I'm like, no. Why? What, are you crazy? You're going to be restless, irritable, and discontent. Drink yourself to sleep and stop. Yeah, finish it up. Stop calling me. And I hang up. Call me when you're sober. All right? Because most of the stuff coming out of their mouth is going to be a lie anyway. That is the step one that I have, okay? It says we admitted we were powerless. And I want to make this statement right now, and I hope I'm making this on tape. I am not powerless over people, places, and things. I am not. I have a God that I will show you in step two that gives me unlimited amounts of power in my life, okay? That's why I've been so successful in most of the things that I've done in my life. In sobriety. I crush that in drinking, but in sobriety, because I believe in this power that we have, our inner power, our inner God, that gives me unlimited power. I am powerless over that alcohol. Once it comes in, it forms the codeine. That I'm powerless over. But I'm not powerless over people, places, and things. I'm not. If I don't like you, I don't hang out with you. If I don't like a place, I move, okay? That thing, I haven't figured out what that was, but it's kind of a saying that we all use. Powerless over people, places, and things. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to dispel a lot of the verbiage that we use here in AA that's just not true. It's not in the big book. It's not our original founders and what they've meant to say. It's not. And why I go on all these speaking engagements is because what I like to do is I'm very mechanical when it comes to the steps. I have gone through this once. I have not in 13 years found any reason to drink. And I've been through a boatload of bad stuff. I've been through unbelievable amounts of good stuff. So for those of you who see this, you'll see step one on this form right here. And it explains what I just talked about. This is right out of the big book. I've come up with the 12 steps in a form over my years. Right out of the big book. If you're interested in this, Pazzi said that he would email it to you for tomorrow so you could print it out. Okay. It also has daily inventories. It has all the, step worksheets for you right out of the big book. Okay. I'm more than happy to share that with you. So that's my experience right now. The unmanageability, that's easy. That was a piece of cake. And I'll tell you that in my story.
After the dash, okay, think about the first step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Dash, that our lives had become unmanageable. Now, what does that mean? What does that mean to you? One of the things that is very, very important in step one is for you to get your own truth about step one. Without your own, you need to fully concede to your innermost self. So without your own concept of your truth with powerlessness, you're not going to have the motivation or the fuel to motor through the rest of the steps. You'll run out of enthusiasm for working the program. However, if you are an alcoholic and you fully concede to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic, you're going to get through the steps. You're going to be consistent with meetings and you're going to sponsor other people and find service commitments. You're just going to do that because you're going to see that that's your best chance of survival. That's your best chance of any quality of life. Because here's the piece in quality of life after the dash that our lives have become unmanageable. Now, when I was first in Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought it was about the cars, the crash in the cars, or the family leaving me, or, you know, the cops always hassling me, or, you know, there was a whole bunch of different problems that I had in my life. And I thought that was the unmanageability. Yeah, my life has become unmanageable. It's hard for me to get a job. You know, I don't have a driver's. That can be looked on as unmanageability, surely. But that's the external unmanageability, the worst type of unmanageability that we have. I'm going to list a few things that are found in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that talk to our unmanageability. And if any of these resonate with you, if you say, oh yeah, I have that, understand that you have work to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, because unless it's a clinical issue, most alcoholics have situational issues. As long as it's not a clinical issue, the treatment for alcoholism treats these problems. Restlessness, irritability, discontent. Does anybody relate to that? How about resentment? You know, really being pissed at people for long periods of time. We don't let go of it. You know, we're going to get them. Might take us 2 or 3 years, but we're going to get them. That's like a deep resentment. Depression, anxiety, self-centered fear and anxiety are kind of the same thing. Just not feeling comfortable with yourself or your environment. You just can't step out and go do the things that you know you would really, really should do, you feel like staying home and pulling the covers over your head a lot of times. Now, that's a view of some of the unmanageable personal relationships. We have problems with personal relationship. We can't seem to keep friends or to not have our family mad at us or neighbors. We're always in conflict with people. Okay? Now, those are kind of a picture of the unmanageability that we suffer when we're sober if we're an alcoholic. Okay? I'm not talking about when we're drinking. I'm talking about if we're alcoholic without a recovery process, that's the type of unmanageability that we suffer from when we're not drinking. It can happen when we're drinking, but mainly what happens with alcoholics is sobriety becomes untenable because a lot of those things are present in our lives and it just makes us uncomfortable. We just want to escape it. We want to escape from the bondage of self that it talks about in AA. Now, toward the end of chronic drinking, some of the unmanageability is the hideous four horsemen: terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair, suicidal thoughts. You know, I could go on and on and on. This really is the unmanageability that is brought about by alcoholism. If you're truly alcoholic, depending on where you are on the scale of alcoholism, you can suffer from these things. Now, do not kid yourself. The things that I've just talked about, there's a treatment for them. If you are suffering from those things because you're alcoholic, the treatment process for alcoholism, the 12 steps, treats those disorders. And I'm not saying you can completely eliminate them from your life, but they can be overcome. The emotional attachment and the emotional pain that we suffer from a lot of these things, we can move past. And we can become happy, joyous, and free. Now, that's something I didn't understand when I came into AA. I was so sick, I just wanted to separate from alcohol. If I could have separated from alcohol, I would have been fine. But the problem was not alcohol. The problem was alcoholism. And with alcoholism comes emotional, spiritual, mental deterioration that just causes uncomfortability and unmanageability across the board. I didn't understand that. And a lot of times we can't understand it until we start to engage in the recovery process. You're so sick, you don't know how sick you are. There's one thing that I always say. Well, I do a lot of work in treatment centers, a lot of speaking in treatment centers, detoxes, rehabs, etc. And I'll hit it right between the eyes, because it says in this book, if we've disturbed you about your alcoholism, or if you've disturbed the new man about his alcoholism, this is all to the good. Because you need the truth. For you to be able to fully concede to your innermost self whether or not you're alcoholic, you need the truth. You need to know what that looks like. What does alcoholism look like? If you asked 100 people on the street, what is alcoholism? You get 100 different answers. Oh, that's a bum on the Bowery. Or that's somebody who's drinking too much. You know, and none of these are really the correct answer of what alcoholism is. Alcoholism is mental, spiritual, physical. It's an obsession of the mind. It's an allergy of the body. It's unmanageability that goes across one's life. That's really what alcoholism is. And certainly, alcohol is present and involved. But more as a solution to the emotional conditions that we have. And it becomes an obsessive solution to the emotional problems that we have. We drink when we don't want to drink. Somehow unconsciously we believe that we can overcome some of these problems by drinking, and so we drink. Now, because we are in, here's the two things that I believe are really true. If you're new, if you haven't gone through the steps yet, if you're back from a relapse, there's two things about you that are very, very true that you're not going to fully believe. One of them is you're in way more trouble than you think you are. However much trouble you think you're in, multiply it by 10, and you'll be getting close to how much trouble you're really in. Okay? And I don't care if you haven't had a drink for 10 years. If you haven't gone through the steps, you're in real trouble. The other thing that's true that you don't believe is that Alcoholics Anonymous has a much larger solution to your problems than you're giving it credit for. Going through the 12 steps and then being of service answers more problems than your problems drinking. That it's going to answer your problems with the unmanageability of your life, the quality of your life. We're not going to promise that you're going to make more money, but we are going to promise that you're going to be a lot happier about whatever you're making. And we're not going to promise that you're going to get better relationships, but we can promise that you're going to enjoy the relationships you have at a deeper and more beneficial level. So if you have any of this unmanageability that I talked about, please consider that there's a recovery process for it. And if you go from one side to the other, you will not come back to me and say, Chris, you lied. You're going to come back to me and say, I never even knew. I've been in a 12-step program all these years, and I never, ever understood what the steps could really do. That's what you'll probably say. Because Alcoholics Anonymous is experiential. You can memorize this book and still be really sick. This is information that needs to be experienced. There's two ways to learn. One is intellectual and one is experiential. You can learn this book intellectually and it won't feed the recovery process. But if you learn this book experientially, if you actually do what it says to do, you'll experience the recovery process.
Saying number two, for dark tunnel AAers, as we call them in the United States. How many people have heard this? Don't drink, go to meetings. That's all they hear. Don't drink, go to meetings. Do they say that out here? Don't drink, go to meetings. Okay. How many people have heard this? Number three. This is a selfish program. Okay, so this is what I heard. Here's this newcomer that comes in 1995. The most selfish person on the earth. I come in, I hear, don't drink, go to meetings, this is a selfish program. I'm like, sign me up. I am the most selfish SOB, you know, and I would look at my then first wife and say, this is a selfish program, and I'm going to go to my ninth meeting today.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, really. And I was working a selfish program. And then I was doing the not drinking, going to meetings. As a real alcoholic, as defined on page 21, real alcoholic, I'll read it to you. I'm one of those. As a real alcoholic on page 21, I need a solution that has weight and depth. Follow me so far? So I'm listening to this, don't drink, go to meetings, don't drink, go to meetings, don't drink, go to meetings. So I'm not drinking, going to meetings. I'm working a selfish program. So what's happening? I got step number one down. Admitted I was powerless over alcohol. My life was crazy. It wasn't even unmanageable. It passed from and manageable, it's crazy. But all the driving while intoxicated stopped, all the beatings of other people stopped, all the fights stopped, but I just was not drinking and going to meetings. So my whole inside is just tore up. So this was my great game plan. After 90 days, in America we get these little trinkets, these gift cards or whatever you want to call them, for not drinking. Isn't that great? So I wanted to pick up that green chip. That's all I wanted. And so after 90 days, I was going to pick up my 90-day chip, because then I proved to all you that I wasn't an alcoholic. Everyone's off my back, although I just lost a killer job. Everybody's off my back. And so I'm sitting there in the chair like this, you know, and they're about ready to give out the chips, because from there, I was going to this thing called Five Point Liquors. I was going to go out drinking, because I made it to 90 days. Now in Florida, we have this beautiful thing. It's called drive-through liquor stores. So when you're too drunk to get out of the car, you drive through. So you know how they knew when I was coming, I'd hit my headlights up against the wall just to make sure I was close enough. And then I'd pull up to the window and I'd roll down and she's like, "Are you having a good night?" And I'd be like, "Meh." So I was leaving that meeting after 90 days and I was going to go get liquor because I was not drinking, going to meetings. That's all I was doing. So,
drinking and go to me.
But I wasn't drinking. You know, I had the white fist and I hooted everybody. I wasn't drinking. So I thought to myself, okay, I'm going out. This guy comes up to me, my first sponsor and still my sponsor to this day. And as I'm running out the door, I'm like, yeah. Like I'm just like trying to get through this crowd of people. They're all congratulating me for not drinking. Thanks. And so the one guy comes up to me, he says, "You know, you're acting a little more strange than usual." And I look at him like, that's pretty damn strange. And he says to me, "Let me tell you something." He says, "Why don't you come over to my house on Tuesdays and Thursdays and I'll bring you through the program of recovery." The program of recovery. What do you think I've been doing for the last 90 days? I've been going to 3 meetings a day because I'm unemployed. You've been dragging me to these jails and these institutions and with all these homeless people, you know, all this stuff. And he says to me, "You've been working a fellowship, which is this right here. You have not been working the program of recovery, which is this right here." So he said, "If you come over to my house on Tuesdays and Thursdays, at 8 o'clock, because I know you're unemployed." Great. I felt great already, right? He says, "And bring your big book. If you come late, don't knock on the door. If you lie to me once, you're out. We understood?" And I'm like, "You arrogant." So anyway, I won't say it on tape. So I had a few choice words and I was like, "You know what? I'll show you this stuff doesn't work." Right? So I started working the steps with him. The first thing he said to me was this on the preface. It says, as we were talking about a solution, it says, "Because this book here," that's kind of beat up, "this book here is the basic text for our society and has helped such large number of alcoholics, men and women, to recovery." Okay. A textbook, folks, is a book that needs to be taught. Now, this is the example that I give to my sponsees. I know I look young. I'm a retired airline captain for one of the airlines in the United States. I don't want to mention it on tape because the stock market will probably crash if I tell you my story and what I used to do with that airline. But I was a captain, pilot, and wait till you hear my story. You're going to love this one.
Hope you're not afraid of flying.
Hope you're not afraid of flying.
This is going to make it much worse.
It is. So I would say, okay, let's say I gave you a 737 flight manual, and I say, "Here you go. This is a textbook. Go home and read it. And come see me after 30 days. How many sponsors in the United States do that? They kill more people than smallpox. They go, "Here, go read this. Tell me what you think.
Read the first step every day for a year."
Yeah, whatever. So I was in a rehab and the guy goes, "Here, read this book. And then tell me what you think." Okay? I was in the rehab. I read the whole 164 pages in 8 hours. I call him up. I'm like, "I don't understand this book. That guy Bill, he's a loser. I don't drink anything like him. And what, I don't understand this 1 through 12 stuff." He goes, "Read it again till you understand it." Well, he's telling me this because he doesn't understand the book. He wants me to explain it to him. I'm in a loony bin. How am I going to explain this to him, right? It's a textbook. It needs to be taught. It's a basic text for our society. back to the analogy. I give you my 737 flight manual, right? And I say, Palsy, go read the 737 flight manual, come back and see me. You come back, you're like, I don't understand it. I put you into the left seat of that airplane, I'm like, okay, spark it up, let's go to America. You look at me like, are you crazy? Well, that's like this book. This book needs to be taught, and it's very important it needs to be taught. The next thing is, in the foreword to the first edition, right here, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered. Recovered, not recovering. Past tense, it's over. We have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. The mind and body is what I've told you about. The craving, that craving, that craving that Chris was talking about. I am not going to drink. If you hooked me up to a lie detector, I would swear and pass that I was not going to drink. But then 5 o'clock comes and I'm like, I'm out of here. Let's go have some toddies. Let's have a couple cocktails, a couple pints, whatever you say here. All right? It says, then once I put that beer into my system, the body's over with. The race is over. I'm going out. I'm a done deal. Just drink until it's all over. So it says, because it says, we have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body to show other alcoholics precisely, and it's in little squiggly lines, precisely, meaning exactly how we have recovered, is the main purpose of this book. So I have a main purpose of this book. I'm going to show you precisely exactly how these people have recovered. Why aren't we all screaming this from the hilltops? Why aren't we all teaching this? I don't get it. Not being very bright is a gift. I believe it's a gift. Being a retired airline captain, I had another gift. I was very good at checklists. My first officer would read something. I'd say, check, read, check, read, check. Okay? When we didn't do the recheck, I would always make a mistake. I'm telling you, we didn't make too many mistakes in the air because I'm still here. People are like, oh, my God, I got to go flying tomorrow. Okay? So it's a checklist. I'm able to follow this checklist. And I believe that's why I came in here just once. It's sure not because I'm better looking than you all. You all are gorgeous. This country is beautiful, isn't it? Beautiful country. And I'm definitely not smarter than anybody in this room. It's because I was given a checklist, and this checklist I followed, okay? And when it said to me that I had I admitted I was powerless over alcohol and what it does to my body and that my life was unmanageable, even after 90 days of sobriety, not drinking, going to meetings, for a real alcoholic, if you tell him, just don't drink, go to meetings, just give him a gun. Tell him to put it to his head and pull the trigger. Because nothing's going to change. The fights may stop. The DWIs, driving while intoxicated, may stop. Walking around Copenhagen naked may stop. But the inner pain will not stop. I promise you that. That is the worst pain, is it not? That is the worst pain that we go to, is that emotional sobriety that Chris was talking about. So what I would like for everybody to walk away here today is I'm going to give you all these little nice little quotes. Think. Don't think, don't think. Don't drink, go to meetings. There's a million of them, okay? And then I'm going to dispel them and show you what the big book says about that. And that's that. You're next.
One of the things, just talk a little bit about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and how it worked. For many, many years, I studied as much as I could find on the history of Alcoholics Anonymous in the early days. Now, for the first 15 or so years of AA, until the book, The 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, was written, Alcoholics Anonymous was different. And how it was different was this. You were, if you were a prospect for Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's what they called you if you were somebody who they were trying to land. You were a prospect. If you were landed, you were then a protege. They've got a habit of calling people all kinds of, names, you know, pigeons, babies, sponsees. Sponsees I use, but anyway, they called the new person, the prospect, and then if the person has started to work the steps, they were then a protege. But anyway, if you were a prospect for Alcoholics Anonymous, you got checked out. Whoever was bringing you in, they were kind of in charge of making sure that you were a real alcoholic, and they would do that by asking you questions. However. Each person would identify you, but they made sure that there were strong drinking issues. And then they started you on the steps. Now, there were some groups that had beginners meetings because they were growing so fast that the one-on-one sponsorship wasn't possible. But more often than not, it was, one man bringing another person through the steps, or a handful of people bringing somebody through the steps. Now, then you were brought to the meetings. So, you were offered the program of recovery, and then you were offered the fellowship when they knew you were serious. When they knew you were serious. Because you had to be pretty serious to start working the steps. You know, pay the money back. You know, I mean, you had to be serious. Now, what changed around the time of the 12 steps and 12 traditions was AA had become very, very big. They opened the doors of AA with the traditions. An honest desire to stop drinking was the only requirement for membership in AA. They couldn't keep you out if you said you had a desire to stop drinking. You were allowed in the meetings. Now that changed everything. I'm not saying for good. It opened the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, but also what it did was it made it okay for you to come to the fellowship before you got the program. So you were allowed to come into meetings and you weren't forced to participate in the recovery process like you were several years earlier. So what happened was that created the dry drunk syndrome. Now, the dry drunk syndrome is basically someone who really is alcoholic who's not living life along spiritual lines, like it talks about in this book. Now, Doug has great analogies. I want to use an analogy here too. We flew over on one of the most wonderful flights I've ever experienced in my life. The service was unbelievable. The American carriers, they like throw a bag of peanuts at you from the front of the plane. You know, I mean, we were like waited on. It was unbelievable.
And they got drunk pilots flying over there.
Yeah, they got like Doug after a couple of toddies, you know. Landing the plane with the oxygen masks coming down. You know? So, but anyway, this was a great experience. To get back to my analogy, let's say all you ever did was go to the airport and sit in the terminal and talk about flying and what it would be like to fly and what it would be like when you got there. And day after day, you kept going to the airport and sitting in the terminal, but you never got on a plane. Well, that's what's happening in Alcoholics Anonymous today. People are coming into the meetings and they're talking about recovery and they're saying, they're talking about the steps. And you know what? They've never really gone through the steps. What we're going to ask you to do in this workshop this weekend is to get on a plane. Okay? Get off your ass. Go down the what's it called, the gangplank?
Are we allowed to say what you just said?
I hope so. Anyway,
jetway.
Jetway. Walk down the jetway and get on the plane. Because I'll tell you, there's some really, really wonderful things in store for you. Here's another analogy that I'll use, in case you're too intellectual to get the simpler one. Let's say you're a calculus student, okay? And you've taken calculus and you're in the calculus class and you like to go there and you like to read the calculus book and go out to the diner after the calculus class and talk about calculus and you know, just hang out with all the calculus people. But you never open up the book and you never do any of the exercises. So you can never solve any of the problems. Well, that's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot today, too. There are people that go into the meetings and they read the book and they talk and they go out to the diner afterward, but they've never gone through these exercises, so they can't solve their own problems. They keep having problem after problem after problem. Have you ever gone to the discussion meetings where the same person shares the same problems? It's just recycling. The problem du jour gets recycled time and time again, and there's seemingly no progress, no spiritual progress in the individual. That's what's happening in Alcoholics Anonymous, surely in the United States. And there's a renaissance going on, getting back to the basics, back to, the principles in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, that's something that we want to be a part of. But, for tonight, what I certainly would recommend for everyone. This will be my exercise. Doug may also have an exercise, but I want you to really be honest with yourself and ask yourself, three questions. You know, is it my experience that the mental obsession has been operative in my life? Have I really, really sworn off alcohol and then ended up back on it? Have I known to the depths of my soul that drinking alcohol was a really, really bad idea, but I did it anyway? Ask yourself those questions. Then ask yourself, once I started to drink, like I went out for two and I ended up closing the place down, or when I'm drinking with my friends, I always seem like I get a lot more drunk than they do. That's the physical craving. Ask yourself, do you have that? Is that your experience? And then ask yourself, do you experience restlessness, irritability, discontent, self-centered fear, resentment, depression, anxiety, remorse, shame, guilt? Do you experience any of that stuff not drinking? And does it seem like when you drink, you can escape that for a short period of time? Ask yourself those questions, because that'll speak to your unmanageability. If you can admit to those three things, it's not good news. You don't come walking away from step one, oh boy, I'm an alcoholic, because it's a death sentence. It's a death sentence unless, well, we're going to talk about step two a little bit tomorrow. But that would be my exercise, for each individual in here. If you choose to do it, you know, there's not going to be a test.
You know, I've had the absolute pleasure of, I have a guy by the name of Joe P. I have a home in Virginia, also. And Joe P had 10 years sobriety. He heard me speak. At that time, I think I had three. Maybe 4 years of sobriety. And I was speaking as I am now because when I was given the message after 90 days of the book, I was the biggest pain in everybody's butt, because all I was doing was getting in your face. See the big book. I know why you drank, because you didn't do the steps and no one wanted me to sponsor them, and I couldn't understand why. You know, my sponsor says, because you're an asshole. That's why. And so as the spirituality came along, I kind of calmed down. I let each person live their own life. But I took this guy, Joe P., through the steps, and he got a huge spiritual awakening. And after the ninth step, he started crying, and he said to me, how come no one has showed me this? And I said to him, well, maybe you just weren't listening. Or maybe there's not enough of us around to help bring this message to the masses. A year after he did the steps, his wife walked up to me. I was throwing a party, and his wife walked up to me crying, saying, thank you for the new husband. I can't tell you how many times I've seen that. So the bad news is, if you're sitting there with restless, irritable, discontent in your own skin now in sobriety, whether you have 90 days, a year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, well, that kind of stinks for you. But the good news is you are going to learn the solution as written in the big book. How many people have heard pink cloud? Do they have that over here? I'm on a pink cloud. It's a pink cloud. It's not a pink cloud, folks. I've been on a 13-year God consciousness. My life is so unbelievable that I breathe rainbows. Even when it's bad, it's great. Do you understand? I'm dead serious about this. My life is phenomenal. I use this book as the nucleus, as the beginning, and then I've built my whole life, my whole spiritual being around this. Because you got to understand, I came in here an atheist. I don't think I mentioned that. Try to do AA as an atheist. You're constantly walking out of meetings because they're talking about God all the time. Another thing is, we live day by day, one day at a time. That may be true. But when I came in this thing, I came in it for permanent sobriety. Don't be afraid to mention permanent sobriety. It states it right in the big book here. It says, this physician, they're talking about Dr. Bob. This physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcohol dilemma, but had failed. Dr. Bob was a great church-going guy. So why was he constantly in and out, in and out, in and out? because he wasn't working any steps. He wasn't making restitution. He had all that guilt. He wasn't doing a four-step. He wasn't admitting his handicaps to another human being, and he wasn't trying to straighten up the past. He just was... Even me, as an atheist, I tried to go to an Episcopal church. Try to do that. I was the cook at 6 o'clock in the morning, so I'd come home from the bar and go to, like, this Episcopal church and start cooking just to, like, find this God that you all were talking about. And, of course, I'd go home and drink, and it was all good because I wasn't working the steps. I wasn't taking action, spiritual action, okay? It says here, Bill Wilson met Dr. Bob and helped him through these helping others. That's what they did in the beginning. And it says here, this seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another as no non-alcoholic could. It also indicated that strenuous work, meaning getting on an airplane last night, getting here 7:30 in the morning, and coming up here all pie-eyed trying to make sense of what we're saying to you, is strenuous work. One alcoholic with another was vital to permanent recovery. Permanent, forever. It mentions it twice in this big book. Permanent recovery, forever. I'm not afraid to say that. I mentioned permanent recovery in a meeting in the U.S. The whole meeting's about me. They'll all start talking about me and about how they're waiting for me to relapse, blah, 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 blah. Because they don't know this book, okay? Permanent recovery. It talks about permanent recovery. Check this out. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, I can't define really tried, but I guess... Like, really tried?
Worked the program.
50% got sober at once. 50% got sober at once. It says here, and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses. 75% sobriety rate. What happened? What do you all think happened? The message got watered down. They got away from this. As Chris was talking about, there's no such thing as a sponsor or sponsee. If you look at the writings between Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson, they wanted to make sure that there was no hierarchy, if you will, okay? That there was no sponsor, that you always counted on God. So they called you sharing partners. You would share your experience, strength, and hope. That is in the big book. That is one saying that really is in the big book. Experience, strength, and hope, okay? So it was the sharing partner stuff. 75% sobriety rate. We're at between 7 and 13 now. That's terrible. And it's because of sayings, just don't drink, go to meetings, take your time working the steps. That is furthest from the truth. I will show you time frames next, launched, immediately, then. Those are words that they use, okay, to take these steps immediately. I have learned a way through studying Dr. Bob on how to take someone through the steps in 4 hours. And I will share that with you, okay, by the time we get done with this.
Couple of things I want to go over. One of them is in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, from the title page to page 44, we're talking about, I don't know, half an inch worth of pages. That's all on step one. That's all information on step one. Bill goes over and over and over again and again and again, example after example. There's Fred. There's Jim. There's the man of 30. There's the hitchhiker. Again and again and again, he's going over examples to give you the information you need to understand what alcoholism is and how it affects you and how it works so that you can fully concede to your innermost self that you are alcoholic. Now, from page 44 to page 88 is basically steps 2 through steps 11. So there's more information on step 1 than there is on step 2 through 11. And there's a lot of information on step 12. So that's the importance of step 1 and step 12. There's a pamphlet. I don't see pamphlets in the back, but pamphlets are real big over in the States. And one of them is called Problems Other Than Alcohol. And that was written by Bill Wilson, you know, back in, I think, the early 60s or so. And what it says in there is it says, the sole purpose of an AA group is the teaching and practice of the 12 steps. When a person drinks, it's not something that's inflicted upon them from someone in authority. It's from their failure to live along spiritual lines. Now, here's another couple of quotes from other literature. This is the foreword to the 12 and 12, and it just explains very, very beautifully what AA really is. AA is a 12-step program. AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. That's beautifully written. I want to be happily and usefully whole. I don't know about anybody else in here. When I was drinking, I wasn't. I was holed up in a room with the blinds shut, listening to music, and my life was getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And I was useful to just about nobody. You know, and today, that really isn't the way it is. Now, here's a warning, and you will find this in tradition 9 on page 174 of the step book. It says, unless each AA member follows to the best of his ability our suggested 12 steps to recovery, he almost certainly signs his own death warrant. His drunkenness and disillusion are not penalties inflicted by people in authority. They result from his personal disobedience to spiritual principles. There it is. Our own death warrant if we don't practice the principles of spiritual living that we find in AA. Now, do we have to do this perfectly? Like if we make a mistake, if we spell a word wrong, you know, no, this is a pass-fail course. And it really, our passing grade is really on our willingness and the amount of effort that we put into it. It's not on how perfect everything is done, how perfect these steps are worked. We just need to be willing to get involved in them. And why? Why? Well, the real reason needs to be that you cannot overcome drinking on your own. And that the power greater than yourself that you're going to need to overcome that drinking must be sought. It says in the A, B's, and C's, A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own affairs. B, no human power could relieve us of our alcoholism, and see that God could and would if he were sought. So we must seek God. That's why we're going to go through the steps. It can't be because of virtue. It can't be because I want to be a better AA member, or it'll make me a better person, or I'll get more chicks. You know, it can't be those reasons. The reasons needs to be survival, because you're going to need that much determination to get through. The steps are not easy to get through. They're really not. The instincts balk at investigation. Our ego is going to try to dissuade us in 100 different ways from doing this. Our egos will tell us all kinds of lies to keep us away from these spiritual practices, because the ego knows that these spiritual practices are designed to destroy the ego. One of the people early on in AA that was very influential was Dr. Henry Thibault. This was somebody that Dr. Bob was involved with, and he was in the psychiatric field. And he wrote a bunch of very, very important essays back in the early days of AA that AA members held on to very tightly. And one of them basically states that ego deflation at depth is necessary for the alcoholic to take the first step. You need to be surrendered. You need to be surrendered. Now, just how much of a surrender? Well, what is surrender? What is a concession? What is surrender? Picture two countries that are at war with each other. Not too hard to imagine these days. And one of them surrenders, and the country that is winning the conflict says, your surrender must be unconditional. And the other country says, okay, anything, let's just stop this killing. Now what happens is the two people come to the table and the conditions of surrender are laid out. And if the country that lost follows those conditions, they're pretty much assured that full-scale assault is not going to take place. Now, what happens if the country decides not to abide by the conditions of surrender? They can open the doors to fresh conflict. Now, we do kind of the same thing in step one when we surrender. Okay, I surrender. Alcohol just destroyed me. I can't fight anymore. I got to get out of the ring. All right, well, you surrender, okay, we're going to accept your surrender, but it's going to be conditional. We're going to give you the conditions upon which your surrender is necessary. And the conditions are in this book. Now, if we fail to, abide by the conditions of alcoholism surrender, we can open up the door to fresh conflict. We can open up the door to a renewed bout of active and acute alcoholism, which is really, really bad news. So, you know, step one really is a concession. It's also a surrender. We need to stop fighting, and we need to become willing to do things that we don't even believe in, and we certainly don't want to do. Because before you start going through the steps, you don't believe that they're going to work. You know what you believe? You believe that you're special, that you're different, that you've got a whole, okay, the steps up on the wall, but if you knew me, you know, I'm going to need all this other stuff. I'm going to need like a team of therapists and, you know, well, you just don't buy the steps. Who the heck buys the steps? I remember I was sober about a week, okay? And this guy that I'm working with comes up to me and he goes, "Hey, so I hear you're going to those AA meetings. You know, what are they like?" And I said, "Well, you know, I drive up to the meeting and I shake hands with the guy outside in front of the meeting, and then I go in, I get a cup of coffee, and then I sit down, and then they say the Serenity Prayer. And then they've got a couple of announcements, and then somebody leads the meeting, and they share that they've got a resentment. And so then other people start raising their hands saying, "Oh, you've got a resentment, I've got a resentment too. Here's my resentment, here's my resentment, here's my resentment." And they pass a basket and everybody puts in a dollar. And then at the end, we all stand in a big circle and we hold hands and we say the Lord's Prayer. He's like, "What?" And I go, "He's right. That doesn't make any sense at all. How can that work? You know?" But I go, "It's only a dollar. You know?" You don't understand. This is all stuff that needs to be learned experientially. So all you can do is kind of have a little bit of faith in the beginning. All right, maybe this Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe these steps things will work. You don't know that they're going to work. You can, at best, you can kind of think that they might work. You know, they've worked for other people. Even though I'm different, maybe they'll help. You know, and I mean, I started moving into the steps basically because I became convinced that it was the answer to my problems by listening to a bunch of tapes. I mean, in my area, there was very few people that were opening the Big Book as a textbook, as a manual to recovery. More or less, it was a fellowship oral tradition type of AA, where you just went to a lot of meetings and, you know, the person with a lot of time, everybody listened to, you know, listen to old Harry, you know, Harry, little, here he goes, you know, the kid underneath every skirt's a slip. You know, and, he'd have all these other words of wisdom, and you'd just like, wow. And I guess they were good, unless you were in real trouble. And, I was in real trouble. So how much time we got?
Seven minutes.
I'm going to take you to, up to We the Ignosis, which is considered step two. And you're going to hear a lot of quotes. And these quotes that I'm about ready to make are out of the Big Book. I'm not making them up. It says here on page 19. How many people have felt like this? We feel, when they use the word "we" in Alcoholics Anonymous, they mean the first 100 people who wrote this book. It was actually 72 because Bill kind of foresaw the future, kind of came up short. But let's just
100 sounded better.
100 sounded better. He was a salesman from New York City. Something like you, actually.
Yeah.
It says here, we feel the elimination of drinking is but a beginning. Well, what part of that are we missing? Don't drink, go to meetings. It's just a beginning. It's a beginning. We, the first 100 feel that the elimination of drinking is but a beginning, a much more important demonstration of our principles. When they talk about principles, they're talking about the 12 steps. Lives before us in our respective homes, businesses, and family affairs. Okay? So that means when I'm in business, and I own a company in the United States, it's a national company, it's a good sized company, that I just cannot lie, cheat, and steal between 9 and 5. Because, oh, it's just business. No, that's not the way it works. Your whole life is a spiritual life. Business is just a part of it to make energy, as I call it. The energy is the cash flow, the money. Okay? So, and also, how are you treating your mate, your children, your loved ones? You could always tell how healthy someone is in AA. Just go into their house. They could be this spiritual guru in these meetings, and all of a sudden they go in the house and they're beating their wives, or they're, you know, kicking the cat, kicking the kids, and, you know, what good does that get you? The next thing we have here, I like this. I want everybody to listen up. You ready? There's three types of alcoholics. Let's see. I want to see if anyone nods on this one. Number one, they call it the moderate drinker. Has little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have a good reason for it. Good reason? I was losing everything. I mean, it was like an eraser. There goes the airline job. There goes the wife. Oh, that's up gone. There goes the two kids, right? I mean, it was gone. It was going. I was watching it go, and I didn't stop. So I'm not a moderate drinker. The next one is, then we have a hard drinker. A hard drinker, two. Okay? He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. Absolutely. I was bleeding all over the place. It says, but, you know, why? I didn't care. It says, it may cause him to die a few years before his time. This is it. If a sufficient strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or a warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man could stop or moderate. As an airline captain in the United States, you have to take a flight physical every 6 months. Okay? And it's a pretty intense flight physical. I'm 32 years old. I go to take my flight physical, and the doctor says to me, wow, your white blood count, because my liver's shutting down, your white blood count is way escalated. And of course, I told him the truth. I'm like, yeah, well, I had the flu. You know.
Gave up red meat.
And it gave up red meat. And so he says, oh, okay, let me just take a little more blood and we'll do extra checks. I'm like, whatever. He goes, but here's your medical, you know, go fly airplanes. So I'm somewhere in Texas, and I get a call from the airline scheduling saying, you got to get to Washington, D.C. to the flight surgeon immediately. And they put me on a positive space airplane. That means I bumped off a paying passenger. So this is pretty big. But what do I think? Great, I get off. There's happy hour in Washington. I can go drink. I was excited. So I walk into this doctor's office. I'll never forget this. There was this lady, and she was cleaning her utensils, and then there was this doctor there, and he looked at me, and he goes, I don't care what you say. He goes, you drink a lot, and you have cirrhosis of the liver. He says, if you continue to drink, you're going to die. So that kind of put a cramp on my happy hour that I wanted to go to.
What did you ask him?
So I sat on the table, and I looked at him just like this. And I said, hypothetically, if I continued to drink, how long would I have to live?
Hypothetically.
The nurse drops the scissors. They both turn to me. They said, are you kidding me? I'm like, just a ballpark figure. Right? So he said 45. I'm 46 now. I'd be dead last year. He says, 45. I'm 32. Be an aerospace engineer. I do the math really quick. I'm thinking, oh, my God.
A lot of time.
13 years. I was so excited, I thought I was going to jump out of my skin. This guy's telling me I'm going to die in 13 years, and I'm like, rock on. So I leave the doctor's office. I'm like, dude, I'm done. No more drinks for me. No more drinks for me. I'll see you later. I'm backing up. I'm bouncing into the door. I'm opening up the door. I'm out of here. No more drinking for me.
Happy hour.
Happy hour. I go into the bar. I'm like, I got 13 years to live. Everyone's like toasting me, and I'm buying drinks for everybody. So I'm not a hard drinker, okay? The next thing says, real alcoholic. What about a real alcoholic? It says he may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, folks, if you're calling alcoholism a career, you may have a problem with drinking.
Important warning sign.
Yeah, yeah. So I had a drinking career. So a drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink, and that was me. Once I started to drink, I was a done deal. And then I got one other one here, and this says here, it says that when therefore we were approached by those who the problem had been solved, the problem has been solved, which I was, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet called the 12 steps. We have found much of heaven, and we are rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence. That is my experience from doing these steps.
We're going to take a 10-minute break. please come back and join us. It'll be a laugh a minute, I promise.
Thanks.